In those 2 seconds between you tapping your card for a coffee and the screen saying approved, a massive invisible accounting chain reaction has basically already begun.
Oh, absolutely. It's an explosion of data.
Right. And we're talking about a sequence of events that can like swing a multi-billion-dollar company's revenue by a factor of eight. And it creates these hidden balance sheet assets worth tens of millions of dollars that, frankly, most people don't even know exist.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal machine. And what's fascinating to me is just how completely obscured it is from the average business operator. I mean, people just assume a credit card transaction is this simple digital handshake,
It's
right?
exactly like you hand over a dollar, the merchant gets a dollar.
Right. But the reality is this incredibly vast, incredibly murky landscape of deferred liabilities, multi-party routing, and just really complex revenue recognition.
And so that is the mission of today's deep dive. We're pulling back the curtain on the highly specific accounting machinery that makes global credit card processing possible.
It's going to get technical, but it's so important.
It is. And I want to speak directly to you, the listener, right now. Because whether you're a controller trying to untangle month-end close, or a finance professional analyzing a fintech stock, or, just someone looking to move beyond surface-level business knowledge into genuine operational fluency.
Which is rare, by the way.
Very rare. But this deep dive is designed to fundamentally change how you look at the mechanics of revenue and cash.
And to map all this out, we are relying on an exceptional grounding source today. We're pulling from a really comprehensive 24-chapter controller's field guide to payments finance.
Yeah, created by Nico Rivera, right?
Exactly. And it covers this deep intersection of ASC 606, revenue recognition, scheme economics, reserves, and the absolute nightmare that is reconciliation.
I love it. I kind of like to think of the payments ecosystem like a swan gliding across a lake, like above the surface from the consumer's perspective. It's just this smooth, elegant, instant tap-to-pay motion.
Right, but below the surface.
Below the surface, it is a frantic, highly engineered, aggressive paddling of general ledger entries. And like intense debates over principal versus agent accounting. We really need to jump into that water.
I'm ready. Let's do it.
So, to understand the accounting, we first have to understand the physical reality of the transaction. Like, we have to know who is actually holding the cash at what exact millisecond.
Which brings us to the four-party reality. So in every standard card transaction, you have the cardholder, obviously,
Right.
then the issuer, which is the cardholder's bank, then the network, and finally the acquirer, which is the merchant's bank.
Okay, four party.
Yeah. But the crucial distinction here, and this is something that trips up a surprising number of finance professionals, is the actual role of the network, because Visa and MasterCard do not actually hold the money.
Wait, really? Because, I mean, that is the ultimate illusion of the plastic in our wallets. Because their logos are stamped right there on the front, we intuitively associate them with the wealth transfer.
Yeah, everyone does, but they are merely the infrastructure. I mean, they are the rule makers, the data routers, and these massive settlement calculators. The actual hard cash is moving directly between the issuer and the acquirer.
So the networks just sit in the middle?
Exactly. They sit in the middle, managing the flow of data, charging a toll for their rails, but they aren't holding the principal balance. So, let's follow the economics on a standard $100 transaction to see how this translates to the general ledger.
Okay, let's do the math.
So the acquirer charges the merchant discount rate, or MDR. Let's peg that at, say, 1.75%. So the merchant is giving up $1.75 to accept that $100 payment.
Okay, but the acquirer doesn't just keep that whole $1.75.
Oh no, not even close. They immediately have to pay the issuer an interchange fee. And for like a standard rewards card, that interchange is about 1.65%.
Wow. So $1.65 goes straight back to the bank that issued the credit card.
Right. And then the network takes their assessment fee for the infrastructure, which is roughly 13 basis points or 13 cents.
Okay, so when you do the math on that, the acquirer collected $1.75, paid out $1.65 in interchange, and paid 13 cents in network fees.
Yeah. So they are left fighting for a net spread of roughly 22 cents. Meanwhile, the merchant receives $97.70.
And, the economics of that haircut look completely different depending on your vertical.
Oh, total.
Like if I'm running a software company with 85% gross margins, surrendering $1.75 on $100 is just a negligible cost of doing business.
It's nothing to them.
Right. But if I'm a grocery chain operating on a razor-thin 2% net margin, that card acceptance cost is massively material. I mean, It eats almost my entire profit on that basket of goods.
And that reality dictates entirely how merchants price their goods and how they negotiate their processing contracts. But for the controller sitting inside the acquiring company, the real headache isn't actually that 22-cent margin itself.
What is it then?
The real headache is the timing of when that 22 cents actually becomes real. We call this the T+ timing trap.
Ah, the timing trap. Because as a consumer, T0 is when I get my coffee. The transaction is done.
Right. But for the controller, T0 is just authorization. The tap happens, the network routes the request, the issuer confirms you have the funds, and a hold is placed on your account.
But no money has actually moved.
Exactly. And critically, no general ledger entry is made for the acquirer at authorization. It is a non-accounting event. It's simply a promise.
Okay, so when does it hit the books?
The actual accounting event happens at T+1, which is called clearing. So the merchant submits their batch of transactions at the end of the day, the transaction data flows to the network, and the network processes it.
And according to the source material, this exact moment of clearing is when the ASC 606 performance obligation is officially satisfied.
Yes, that is the magic moment.
So the acquirer is booking revenue at clearing, but the cash still hasn't moved.
Right.
I mean, if you are recognizing revenue before the physical dollars arrive at the final settlement phase, you are setting yourself up for an absolute reconciliation nightmare.
Oh, it's brutal.
You are claiming a piece of that $100 transaction that isn't sitting in your corporate bank account yet.
Yeah, it creates an enormous puzzle on the balance sheet. Because the cash doesn't actually move until settlement, which happens anywhere between T+1 and T+2.
Right.
That is when the network looks at all the billions of transactions across all its members, nets out exactly what acquirers owe issuers in interchange, what issuers owe acquirers in gross settlement, and finally instructs the central settlement banks to move the funds.
So during that window between clearing and settlement, the balance sheet must just look like a war zone.
That is a great way to put it.
Because you have three simultaneous items representing the exact same transaction, just trying to balance. You have a settlement receivable, which is the cash you are owed from the network.
Right.
You have a merchant payable the cash you owe to the merchant for their coffee sales.
Yeah.
And you have your recognized 22 cents of revenue.
And at month end, a controller might be looking at hundreds of millions of dollars in settlement receivables and merchant payables if any of those timing boundaries are fuzzy.
Like what?
Well, like, if an authorized transaction gets improperly swept into a cleared batch before it's actually processed by the network, the entire financial close breaks, the trial balance won't tie out.
Oh, man. The amount of tension in the system just waiting for those physical dollars to catch up to the data is incredible.
Hmm.
So, okay, we know revenue is recognized at the clearing phase, but now we have to tackle what the source calls the most consequential accounting decision a payments company makes.
Yeah.
It's not when to record the revenue,
but
how much revenue to actually record.
This is the ASC 606 principal versus agent debate. And it is the single accounting policy that can fundamentally alter the perceived size and really the valuation of a payments business.
So going back to our $100 tap, the acquirer charged the merchant $1.75. But after paying the issuer and the network, they only kept 22 cents.
Right.
So when this acquirer reports their top-line revenue to Wall Street, do they report the full $1.75 or just the 22 cents?
That is the gross versus net presentation battle. If they report the full $1.75 as revenue and then report the $1.65 of interchange as a separate cost of goods sold, that is gross presentation.
They're asserting they act as the principal in the transaction.
Exactly. But if they only record their 22 cents spread as revenue, asserting they are merely an agent facilitating the flow of funds, that is net presentation.
But I would assume JAP rules dictate a single correct answer for a single type of transaction. I mean, it's the exact same $100 coffee purchase either way.
You would think so. But the source reveals a fascinating reality here. Both can be technically correct under GAAP. It depends entirely on the specific operational facts of the business model.
Like what kind of facts?
The determining factors involve asking questions like, does the acquirer control the payment service before it's transferred to the merchant? Do they bear the primary responsibility for the payment going through? Do they bear the ultimate credit risk if the merchant goes under? And crucially, do they have the discretion to set the pricing?
Ah, okay. It actually reminds me of a general contractor building a house.
Oh, I like that. How so?
Well, if the general contractor buys all the lumber, hires all the subcontractors, and assumes the massive financial risk if, say, the foundation cracks. They book the entire $1 million price of the house as their top-line revenue.
Mm.
That's gross presentation.
Right.
But if the contractor is just a consultant who introduces the homeowner to a lumberyard and takes a 2% finder's fee, they only book the $20,000 fee as revenue. That's net presentation.
That analogy holds up perfectly in this acquiring world. Full stack acquires, you know, the massive legacy banks that own their proprietary processing platforms, sign merchants directly on their own paper, bear all the chargeback risk, and dictate the pricing matrix.
They're the general contractor.
Exactly. They have a very strong, defensible argument for gross presentation.
But the landscape is totally flooded with newer tech players now, like payment facilitators, PayFacs, and independent sales organizations, ISOs. They're often just aggregating merchants underneath a bigger bank's infrastructure.
And those players lean heavily toward net presentation. They don't bear the same ultimate structural risk, and they often don't have total control over the pricing or the underlying authorization rails, so they cannot claim the gross revenue.
They are the consultant taking the finder's fee.
Exactly.
The financial statement impact of this choice is just staggering. The source explicitly notes that gross presentation reports roughly 8 times more revenue than net presentation for the exact same underlying economic reality.
8 times.
Think about the implications for a tech CEO preparing for an IPO. Public market analysts track revenue growth and top-line multiples obsessively. If I can convince my auditor that I'm a principal, I can inflate my top-line revenue by a factor of 8.
Yeah, your margins look thinner because of the massive interchange expense, but your sheer scale looks dominant.
Exactly.
And we see immense pressure from executive teams trying to justify gross presentation for exactly that reason. But a controller cannot simply wake up and decide to switch from net to gross to juice the valuation.
Right. The auditors would have a field day.
Oh, changing this presentation is an ASC 250 accounting change. It is a highly scrutinized, auditable event. A company has to produce deep technical memos proving that the fundamental facts of their operational model have shifted, like that they took on new credit risk or new pricing authority to warrant the shift.
Okay, so we've established how to book the revenue, but we really need to look at the massive expense offsetting it. That $1.65 interchange fee we keep mentioning isn't a static number.
No, not at all.
The source makes it clear that interchange is notoriously unstable. It makes up 70-85% of total processing costs, and it consists of literally hundreds of different rate categories.
Yeah, interchange is this complex shifting matrix.
Yeah.
The rate changes based on almost everything about the transaction. It depends on the card type. Like, a basic debit card costs significantly less to process than a high-end travel rewards card.
Sure, that makes sense.
It depends on the merchant category code. Grocery stores get specialized lower rates compared to luxury retail or e-commerce. It even depends on the physical environment. Was it a secure chip insertion at a terminal or a riskier manual entry on a website?
And it also depends on the specific data passed along with the transaction, which is something most people outside of B2B payments completely ignore.
Level 2 and level 3 data, yeah.
Right. So the networks incentivize B2B merchants to pass highly detailed line item data like invoice numbers, freight amounts, exact tax amounts.
Because it dramatically reduces the risk of fraud and disputes, and corporations use that data to monitor their employees' corporate card spending.
So if a merchant passes all that data perfectly, they get a preferred rate, let's say a commercial rate of 2.10% on a $50,000 raw materials purchase.
But if their point-of-sale software glitches or a clerk just forgets to enter the zip code and the transaction fails to pass that level 3 data,
what happens?
It gets penalized by the network. This is called a downgrade. That preferred 2.10% rate can instantly downgrade to an EIRF, or electronic interchange reimbursement fee, or even a standard rate, which can be as high as 3.50%.
Oh, wow. Going from 2.1% to 3.5% on a $50,000 transaction just destroys the marketing completely.
Destroys it.
That 22-cent spread we calculated earlier vaporizes. The acquirer actually loses money processing that payment if they haven't structured their merchant pricing to pass those downgrades through.
And identifying these downgrades is a controller's nightmare, primarily because of billing lags. Visa and MasterCard do not bill acquirers in real time.
They don't.
No. The consolidated billing statement arrives 15 to 20 days after the month ends.
Oh, so the controller is sitting there on like day 3 of the new month, trying to close the books and report earnings to the CEO, and they are flying completely blind regarding their biggest expense.
Exactly. If a controller attempts to close the books based only on the invoices they actually have in hand, their costs will be systematically drastically understated.
So we have to guess.
They are forced to accrue or estimate the interchange expense. But this is where the invisible drift of the matrix catches them. If their accrual model assumes a normal historical mix of basic cards and properly formatted B2B transactions, but suddenly a merchant has a software issue causing thousands of downgrades.
Or a holiday surge causes consumers to heavily use premium rewards cards.
Exactly. The effective interchange rate drifts upward, invisibly.
And the controller has no idea the margin is eroding until the actual invoice hits 3 weeks later.
It's terrifying. And the chaos extends beyond just monthly billing lags. The source highlights the multiple cycle problem because not all scheme fees follow a monthly cadence.
Like the quarterly ones.
Right. The fixed acquirer network fee, or FANF, is a perfect example. It is a massive fee billed quarterly, calculated based on complex tiers involving the number of merchant locations and processing volume.
Okay.
If a finance team only accrues for monthly fees, they are setting a trap for themselves. Imagine a CFO presenting what looks like a fantastic Q2, only to have a massive, unbudgeted $400,000 FANF expense detonate the Q3 P&L simply because the controller forgot to amortize a quarterly fee into the monthly close.
Hey, boss, sorry about that 400 grand. Hmm? That is a fast track to an intense conversation with the audit committee.
You'd be updating your resume.
Seriously. So a payments controller cannot be a historian just recording invoices. They have to build forward-looking accrual models that anticipate the matrix. They have to monitor card mix shifts daily. Okay, we have covered the absolute chaos of the income statement. But while controllers are fighting over fractions of pennies on the P&L, there are tens of millions of actual physical dollars pooling up in the background waiting to settle.
Yes, the balance sheet.
Which brings us to balance sheet warfare. The source outlines how this cash creates both hidden profit centers and massive risk buffers. So let's start with the profit center. Float.
Float. Float is the hidden value of the T-plus timing trap we discussed earlier.
Right.
So the network settles funds to the acquirer, but there is usually a 1 to 1.5 day operational lag before the acquirer actually pushes that funding into the merchant's bank account.
So the acquirer is just sitting on a mountain of cash for 36 hours?
Exactly. And in a high interest rate environment, that cash is incredibly valuable. It generates income through internal funds transfer pricing, or FTP.
And the math provided in the source is just eye-opening here. Let's say an acquirer is processing $500 million in daily gross payment volume, or GPV, with a 1.5 day settlement lag at a 4.5% internal FTP rate.
Yeah, that acquirer is generating roughly $85,000 per day in float income.
$85,000 a day. That's over $31 million annualized in pure zero-cost revenue. They haven't charged a single merchant fee, they haven't processed a single software subscription, and they're making $30 million just by holding the money.
It is a massive line item on the balance sheet, but it sets up a brutal strategic trade-off between the product team and the finance team.
Because merchants hate waiting.
Exactly. Merchants despise waiting a day and a half for their money. They want instant access to their cash to manage their own payroll and inventory, so the product team demands an instant settlement feature to win market share from competitors.
But instant settlement actively destroys float.
It obliterates it. If a company moves 20% of its total volume to an instant settlement product, that provides incredible value to the merchant. But it acts as a direct, quantifiable hit to the acquirer's FTP income.
So the controller has to model exactly how much float income they are sacrificing to offer that feature, and whether the new market share offsets the lost $30 million.
That's the tightrope they walk.
Okay, so that is the hidden upside of the balance sheet. But we have to look at the downside, the risk buffer. This brings us to the mechanics of reserves under ASC 450. Because in this four-party model, the acquirer is the financially liable party if things go sideways.
They are the ultimate backstop, yes.
So let's trace a scenario. A merchant sells $10 million worth of custom, built to order furniture in January. The acquirer processes those transactions, takes their 22-cent spread, and funds the merchant the $10 million. But in February, before any of the couches are actually manufactured or shipped, the furniture company files for bankruptcy.
This happens all the time, and the customers immediately call their issuing banks and initiate chargebacks because they never received the goods.
Right.
The network rules are very clear here. The acquirer is left holding the bag. The chargebacks hit the acquirer, but when the acquirer tries to claw the money back from the merchant's bank account, it's empty. So the acquirer has to pay those millions of dollars in chargebacks out of their own corporate treasury.
Ouch. So to prevent that catastrophic loss, the acquirer evaluates the risk of that furniture merchant on day one and decides to withhold some of their money up front as a safety net.
They build a reserve. The source details three main types. First, a rolling reserve, where the acquirer might hold back, say, 10% of every daily batch for 90 days before releasing it to the merchant.
Okay.
Then there's a capped reserve, which operates similarly but stops withholding once a specific dollar target is hit. And lastly, an upfront reserve, where they demand a lump sum of cash wire transferred before they even allow a high-risk merchant to begin processing.
From an accounting perspective, simply building that physical reserve, it's just a balance sheet movement, right? Like, you debit cash and credit a merchant reserve liability, you are just holding their money in escrow. It doesn't hit the income statement.
Right, but this is where ASC 450 governing contingencies gets tricky. You don't take an expense when you build the reserve. However, when those chargebacks actually start arriving and you realize the merchant's funds are going to be insufficient to cover them, you have to book a credit loss reserve.
Okay.
This is an accrual under ASC 450, and it is a current period expense. You're recognizing a probable, estimable future loss on your income statement today.
So if you misjudge the risk of your portfolio, your expenses spike and your margins collapse. But what happens if you over-reserved? Like, what if the furniture merchant survives, delivers all the couches, and the risk window closes?
Then you release those excess reserves from prior periods. You debit the liability and credit the income statement. It flows back as an earnings benefit.
And this creates a severe masking effect. Releasing old reserves to pad a bad quarter feels like a dangerous earnings management game.
It's very dangerous.
Let's say a company has a terrible Q3. Core processing volume is flat, interchange downgrades chewed up the margins, but leadership decides to release a massive chunk of excess reserves they've been sitting on for 2 years.
Suddenly, net income looks fantastic.
Right. And conversely, they could have an explosive quarter of volume growth. But if they had to build a massive new ASC 450 loss reserve for a risky client portfolio, the expense drags net income down, making it look like a weak quarter to external investors.
And the source explicitly warns about this temptation. A true ethical controller must present the numbers cleanly. In internal management reporting, and especially in external disclosures, they have to present the volume story, you know, the core operational processing performance, completely separate from the reserve movement story.
Right, because if you blend them together on a single line item, you're just obscuring the fundamental health of the business.
Precisely.
Okay, so we know reserves exist to catch losses. But let's look at the actual accounting forensics when a merchant fails and those losses materialize. The source material points out this is not a one-and-done event. It creates multi-period nightmares. Let's start with the daily grind of the dispute business. Chargebacks versus fraud.
To a consumer, a stolen card and a dispute over a broken couch are both just fraud. But to a payments controller, the accounting taxonomy is totally distinct.
How so?
Well, a chargeback is a highly structured network mechanism. It's a valid dispute initiated by the issuer, resulting in a direct debit to the acquirer. The acquirer then has a specific time window to fight it, a process called representment, by providing proof of delivery or a signed contract.
And controllers model this statistically, right? Like, if you have an 8 basis point chargeback rate on $500 million in volume, that's $400,000 in gross monthly exposure. And if historical data shows you win 30% of those representment fights, your net exposure is $280,000. If policy requires 90 days of coverage, you mathematically need an $840,000 reserve sitting on the balance sheet. It's predictable.
But true fraud, in the accounting sense, is entirely different. True fraud is when funds settle, the criminal merchant immediately withdraws the cash and vanishes, and no chargeback mechanism exists because the transactions were artificially generated.
Oh, man. So it's a total unrecoverable loss.
Right. Chargeback losses flow smoothly through the statistical reserve model. True fraud bypasses the reserve entirely and is a direct, immediate write-off to the P&L.
And just when a controller thinks they have modeled the statistical chargebacks and buffered against the true fraud, they get hit with compliance fines.
Ah, yes. Visa's VDMP, the Visa Dispute Monitoring Program, and VFMP, the Visa Fraud Monitoring Program.
What are those?
Visa actively monitors the ecosystem's health. If a merchant's ratio of fraud to sales volume crosses a specific threshold, say 0.9%, Visa forces the acquirer into these remediation programs.
Because Visa doesn't want toxic volume on their rails, so they penalize the acquirer for bringing bad actors into the network.
And the penalties are severe. The minimum charges are often $25,000 per month just for being in the program, escalating rapidly based on the number of dispute counts.
Wait, they fine you just for being in the program?
Yes. And crucially, these fines do not show up politely. You often don't know a merchant breached the ratio until the network invoice arrives weeks later.
Oh.
Furthermore, these are categorized as scheme fee expenses, not credit losses, so they don't flow through the chargeback reserve model we just built. They're an entirely separate accrual blind spot.
It's like navigating a minefield blindfolded.
Huh.
But let's talk about the ultimate explosion, the merchant bankruptcy. The source material calls this the ultimate accounting stress test.
It really is.
Let's say my massive custom furniture merchant just filed for Chapter 11. My settlement receivable is frozen. What is the immediate accounting trigger? Am I recognizing that loss today or waiting for the court?
You are likely recognizing entries across potentially 4 years of financial statements.
4 years?
Yeah. It evolves through distinct phases of realization. Initially, you identify the risk. Maybe you see they're paying suppliers late or their volume drops. You proactively build an ASC 450 reserve, taking a current period expense based on probable loss.
Then the situation escalates. We freeze their processing. We place a hold on their funds.
But the settlement receivable, the cash the network owes you for their final few days of swiping cards, just sits frozen on your balance sheet as an asset. You can't touch it, but you haven't technically lost it yet.
Okay.
Then the loss materializes. The angry customers who never got their furniture initiate a wave of chargebacks. Those chargebacks exhaust the reserve you built, and any excess hits your credit loss expense directly.
And then the official hold filing happens. The merchant goes into Chapter 11 and or Chapter 7.
Right. Now you are looking at that frozen settlement receivable from the final days of processing. You assess what you might realistically recover from the bankruptcy estate as a creditor. If you estimate you'll only see 20 cents on the dollar, you have to formally write down the other 80 cents as bad debt expense.
The psychological and accounting tension of locking a merchant's funds, watching the chargebacks roll in daily, and defending the adequacy of that reserve to an auditor is just immense.
And it doesn't end there. Because years later, the bankruptcy court finally concludes its distributions.
And you receive a check for that 20 cents on the dollar.
Exactly. You have to book that as a recovery, which flows back through your income statement, impacting earnings in a completely different fiscal year than the original transaction.
Accounting for a merchant bankruptcy is like tracking radioactive material. I mean, you must maintain a completely clean, perfectly auditable chain of custody across multiple years. Every single period's entry. The initial reserve, the write-down, the recovery, years later, must stand entirely on its own merits based solely on what was knowable at that exact point in time.
You cannot use hindsight from year three to retroactively adjust the entry you made in year one.
Unbelievable. Okay, we've spent all this time surviving the acquiring side, but the source material insists that to truly understand the economics, a controller must look at the exact same transaction from the issuer's perspective, the cardholder's bank, because interchange is a zero-sum game.
It is. That $1.65 interchange fee that serves as an agonizing expense for the acquirer.
Yeah.
That is the exact same $1.65 functioning as top-line revenue for the issuing bank. It is the same dollar sitting on the opposite side of the global P&L. If an acquirer is negotiating a massive co-brand deal with a bank, understanding the bank's precise interchange margins provides tremendous leverage.
But the issuer has their own margin pressures, right? I mean, I get 1.5% cash back on every purchase. That money has to come directly out of the issuer's interchange revenue.
It's the rewards drain. A 1.5% cashback program costs the issuing bank roughly 0.9 cents per dollar processed. So that 1.65% interchange revenue instantly nets down to roughly 0.75% after they account for your cashback and their own network assessment fees.
And what about the credit risk? If I default on my credit card, the acquirer doesn't care. The merchant got paid. That default is entirely the issuer's problem.
And the accounting standard governing that risk is fundamentally different. Acquirers use ASC 450, where they reserve when a loss is probable and estimable. Issuers use ASC 326, known as CECL, current expected credit losses.
That implies a forward-looking model. How does CECL mechanically work on day one of a new credit card account?
Under CECL, an issuer must estimate and reserve for the lifetime expected credit loss on the exact moment the credit card is originated. They do not wait for you to miss a payment.
Wait, on day one?
Yes. The day they mail you the plastic, they look at macroeconomic indicators, your FICO score, and historical cohort data, and they must book an expense for the statistical probability that you will eventually default over the life of that card. It requires massive data modeling and is far more aggressive than ASC 450.
So if I'm a controller, I'm steering an acquirer system tracking T+1 clearing and ASC 450 probable losses, and an issuer system tracking lifetime CECL and rewards points. How do these systems actually talk to each other? What is a tiebreaker when the internal ledger says one thing and the bank says another?
Welcome to the reconciliation triangle. This is the daily battleground. You have three systems that describe the exact same transaction, and they never perfectly agree natively.
Never.
Never. You have the network settlement file, the TC46 for Visa, or the IPM for MasterCard. This is the absolute, unassailable source of truth. It dictates what actually cleared and what cash will move. Second, you have your internal processing system, which tracks the operational state of the transaction. And third, you have the general ledger.
But why wouldn't they agree? $100 is $100. If the operational system says a $100 tap happened, the network file should show $100.
Because of what the source identifies as the fatal flaw in reconciliation, utilizing the wrong volume definition, there isn't a single monolithic metric called volume. There are five distinct states: authorized, cleared, settled, reported, and eligible.
Okay, so if I'm building an accrual model and I pull a report of authorized volume from my internal system to estimate my interchange expense, what happens?
You guarantee a systemic variance. Authorized volume includes transactions where a hold was placed on a card, but the customer canceled the order before shipping or the batch failed to transmit.
Oh, I see.
Those transactions exist in your internal system, but they will never clear the network and they will never settle. So your general ledger shows an accrued expense based on authorizations, but the TC46 network file will never show that expense. The variance will grow every single month and will be unresolvable. You must align your accruals precisely with cleared volume, because clearing is the true accounting event.
Investigating that variance bridge sounds miserable. What does a $50,000 variance even look like when you process billions of dollars? How do you isolate it?
It requires extreme operational fluency. You have to isolate the variance by bank identification number or BNN range or by specific merchant category codes to figure out exactly which subset of transactions cleared the network but failed to record in the internal system, perhaps due to a midday server outage or a time zone cutoff discrepancy.
And controllers have to do this under the pressure of the monthly close calendar. The source breaks down a grueling day 1 to 15 schedule. Day 1 is receiving the final files. Days 2 through 5 are spent building the revenue accrual based on the actual card mix that cleared, trying to anticipate that invisible interchange drift we talked about.
Then days 6 through 10 hit, and the actual network billing invoices finally arrive. The controller compares their accrual guess to the actual invoice, trues up the scheme fees, and identifies the gaps. Days 10 through 15 are spent finalizing the variance bridge, explaining the gaps to the CFO, and locking the ledger.
And just when a controller masters the traditional card rails, the landscape shifts underneath them. Which brings us to future-proofing the balance sheet. Controllers are now forced to apply these legacy accounting frameworks to entirely new payment paradigms. Let's start with buy now, pay later. Klarna, Affirm. How does BNPL break the accounting models we just mapped out?
It depends entirely on where you sit in the transaction flow. If you are a traditional acquirer and you process a transaction where the consumer is using Klarna well, your accounting is actually quite simple. To you, Klarna is essentially just the merchant. You process the transaction, collect vanilla MDR revenue, and you are done. Klarna is the one taking the massive credit risk on the consumer paying them back in 4 installments.
But what if I'm a legacy bank and I decide to issue my own BNPL product to compete with Klarna? Now I hold the multi-installment receivable.
Exactly. Now you face those day one CECL obligations under ASC 326. You have to estimate the lifetime credit loss of those 4 future installments before the consumer even makes the first payment.
Oh, that's tough.
And furthermore, you wrestle with incredibly complex deferred revenue recognition. The merchant discount fee you charged was collected upfront at the point of sale, but your service of managing the installments and collecting the debt stretches over weeks or months. You have to defer that revenue and recognize it over the life of the loan.
It's the gross versus net debate stretched across the dimension of time. And speaking of new paradigms, Crypto and stablecoins must be an absolute wild west for a traditional corporate controller trying to park excess cash.
It was, but a massive regulatory shift is happening. Historically, under the old rule, ASC 350, crypto was treated as an intangible asset.
Which means what?
This was a brutal standard. It meant you had to measure it at cost, and if the market value dropped, you had to write it down as an impairment charge on the P&L. But if the value subsequently rallied to an all-time high, you were strictly prohibited from recording the recovery. It was a one-way street of downside risk.
That is incredibly punitive. If my corporate treasury holds Bitcoin and the market tanks, my books look terrible. But if it recovers, my books still reflect the historical loss.
Right.
No wonder traditional finance hated holding it.
Exactly. But ASU 2023-08, which becomes effective in January 2025, completely rewrites the playbook. It moves in scope crypto assets to fair value measurement.
Okay, so that fixes it.
Yes. This introduces symmetrical gains and losses. Mm. If the value drops, you recognize the loss. If it rallies, you recognize the gain. The asset is marked to market every reporting period, reflecting its true economic reality.
Well, what about stablecoins like USDC? They are explicitly pegged to the US dollar, so a controller should just be able to treat them as cash or cash equivalents on the balance sheet, right?
You would think so, but stablecoins are heavily contested by auditors. They are not legally cash, and they do not cleanly meet the definition of cash equivalents.
Because of counterparty risk.
Right. The Silicon Valley Bank crisis in 2023 proved this definitively. When SVB collapsed, USDC briefly depegged from the dollar because a portion of its backing cash reserves were trapped inside the failing bank.
Wow, yeah.
That proved to the accounting world that stablecoins carry material counterparty and impairment risk. The moment the peg breaks, the illusion of risk-free cash evaporates.
That is a phenomenal reality check. If the backing institution fails, the digital token is just an impaired receivable.
Mm.
Okay, we have one final sleeper risk to cover, and I find the legal mechanics of this philosophically fascinating.
Escheatment.
Escheatment is the silent killer of the balance sheet.
It really is.
It is the legal process where unclaimed financial funds must eventually be remitted to the state government. For a payments company, this liability accumulates invisibly. Uncashed settlement checks to merchants who moved, unredeemed gift card balances, abandoned reserves from merchants who went bankrupt and the owners disappeared.
After a statutory dormancy period, usually 3 to 5 years, depending on the jurisdiction, you cannot just absorb that money as corporate profit. You are legally obligated to hand it over to the state.
And based on the source material, I see a massive double exposure trap here regarding revenue recognition.
Mm.
Under ASC 606, companies are allowed to look at their gift card program and use historical data to determine that, say, 10% of these cards are lost in a drawer and will never be used. They're allowed to recognize that 10% as breakage revenue today. They book the profit and distribute it to shareholders.
They absolutely do, but that is exactly where the trap snaps shut during a state audit.
Because many state governments refuse to acknowledge that ASC 606 breakage extinguishes the legal escheatment obligation.
Yes. They will audit the company, look at the unredeemed balances, and say, we don't care about your GAAP revenue recognition models. That is an unredeemed customer balance, and under state property law, it belongs to us.
So a company can recognize $1 million in breakage revenue today, pay corporate taxes on that phantom profit, and then 5 years later, the state demands they hand over that exact same $1 million in hard cash.
It is a devastating double exposure. The P&L recognized the revenue, but the balance sheet never maintained the liability or the cash reserve to fund the eventual outflow to the state.
The irony is incredible. Escheatment is essentially the state stepping in as the ultimate merchant of last resort. The company pays taxes on the phantom breakage revenue, only to have the exact same government demand the principal balance a half decade later. It's a brilliant mechanism for the state treasury and terrifying for the controller.
Which perfectly synthesizes the core message of this entire deep dive. I mean, what actually separates a truly great payments finance professional from a mediocre one? It is not just knowing debits and credits. The source outlines three distinguishing traits.
Let's hear them.
First is operational fluency. A great controller doesn't just know the journal entry. They know what a TC46 file is. They know why a midnight badge cutoff discrepancy alters the month-end revenue. They understand the physical plumbing of the transaction, not just the math.
Second is translating across audiences. A controller has to sit in a boardroom and explain margin compression to a CFO using simple business logic like a holiday shift toward premium rewards cards,
right,
causing interchange downgrades.
Right.
But then they have to turn around and defend that exact same margin compression to an external auditor using rigid ASC 606 principle versus agent frameworks and ASC 450 reserve adequacy models.
And the third trait is proactive disclosure. The controllers who survive in advance do not wait for the 15-day delayed network invoice to tell them they lost money. They build accrual models that anticipate the matrix drift. They accrue for the compliance fines before the bill arrives. The source explicitly mentions that combining a traditional CPA license with a CPP, a certified payments professional credential, creates compounding career value.
That makes total sense. You gain the universal language of accounting layered with the hyper-specific, arcane domain knowledge of the four-party model. We have covered an immense amount of ground today. But payments is fundamentally a balance sheet story, not just an income statement story. I highly encourage you to go look up the real-world 10K annual reports of publicly traded acquiring companies.
Definitely.
Look at Nuvei or Global Payments or Shift4. Search the document for ASC 606 or principal versus agent. Read their risk factors regarding reserve methodologies. You will see everything we dissected today happening in the wild, governing the movement of billions of dollars.
Seeing the theory applied in the footnotes of public filings really bridges the gap between academic accounting and operational reality.
Now, to wrap us up, I want to circle back to the swan on the lake. Smooth tap on the surface, a frantic, complex, multi-day paddling of T+2 settlement, reconciliation, and float management underneath. We've spent the last hour dissecting how 22 cents of spread is fought over, accounted for, downgraded, and reserved against in this multi-day dance of risk.
And it is a dance.
But I want you to mull over this final provocative thought. We are entering an era of central bank digital currencies and instant settlement mandates. The global technology infrastructure is rapidly moving toward eliminating the T+2 delay entirely. So the question isn't just how you account for the cash anymore. The question is what happens to the massive, highly engineered financial machinery of acquiring? What happens to the $31 million of pure float income? When the time value of money in a transaction goes to absolute zero, when the frantic paddling beneath the surface stops and the swan just flies.
The evaporation of float will fundamentally rewrite the unit economics of the entire industry. That is the existential question for the next decade of payments finance.
And we will leave you to ponder it. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.